This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
10 little soldier boys went out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were 9. 9 little soldier boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were 8. 8 little soldier boys travelling in Devon. One said he'd stay there, and then there were 7. 7 little soldier boys chopping up sticks. One chopped himself in halves, and then there were 6. 6 little soldier boys playing with a hive. A bumblebee stung one, and then there were 5. 5 little soldier boys going in for law. One got in chancery, and then there were 4. 4 little soldier boys going out to sea. A red herring swallowed one, and then there were 3. 3 little soldier boys walking in the zoo. A big bear hugged one, and then there were 2. 2 little soldier boys sitting in the sun. One got frizzled up, and then there was 1. 1 little soldier boy left all alone. He went and hanged himself, and then there were none. Frank Green, 1869. Chapter 1. In the corner of a first-class smoking carriage, Mr. Justice Wargrave, lately retired from the bench, puffed a cigar.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Buy the Book. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me, as always, my fellow detective,
sometimes.
Erstwhile detective.
Not very successfully, but definitely a fan.
Sharmila Ganesan. And we are diving into the next of our bibliography episodes. Today, we are focusing on a classic. So we're going to be speaking about Dame Agatha Christie.
Yes, the queen of mysteries.
The mistress of murder.
I know. I constantly forget that she is, I think, quite definitively the best-selling author of fiction worldwide of all time. And I think the fact that that surprises me every time I hear it is indicative of how here's someone who's got such a huge legacy when it comes to fiction, when it comes to mystery novels, and yet is often overlooked in a weird way.
Yeah, or perhaps not often thought of. And I think perhaps that has to do with genre, right? Mm. We've talked about this on the show time and time again, but I think sometimes the most likely suspect is, in fact, the one who is the perpetrator of the crime. And in this case, I think it's very much to do with when you're a genre writer, you just kind of get lumped in with that. You know, you get a little bit dismissed and people don't necessarily think of you as having the legacy that someone like Agatha Christie actually does, because she is the best-selling fiction writer of all time. But she is also, I think, the most translated individual writer. And that says something about the storytelling, considering the fact that most of the stories are to do with a very specific breed of upper-class British person. maybe that also speaks to colonialism. I don't know. But we'll get to that. For the time being, Dame Agatha Christie. She was born Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller. She had 2 husbands after, so the Christie came from her first. But yeah, she was born into a relatively well-to-do family.
Yes, in the late 1800s in Britain. But I think what's quite significant and quite interesting about her upbringing is that she was homeschooled for most of her childhood, and her mother, who she was very, very close to, I think felt very strongly that she should learn to not just read but be exposed to all of these different things. You know, she was interested in all of these disparate fields, and you can kind of see that materializing later as she grew up as well. And she was a voracious reader. And I think that's something that I've always loved. I love when you find out that all of these writers that were prolific and quite great at what they did were these little readers who just couldn't put their books down, because I feel like you can definitely connect. That's where that comes from.
Yes. And also the fact that she was a relatively lonely child, because she was the youngest child. And I think she kind of came along at a time where the family also moved shortly after she was born. Her father passed away at the age of 11. And so by that point, her siblings were off getting married or, you know, living in other countries. And so she described her childhood as a happy one, but also as one where she spent a lot of time with imaginary friends. And I think similar to what you were saying earlier about being a voracious reader, another hallmark of many, many writers' biographies when you read it is that they had tons of imaginary friends and spent lots of time making up conversations and stories for them.
Yes, and I just wanted to point out that I just found out today, actually, while researching the show, that one of her early childhood favorite reads was actually Edith Nesbit. And I love the fact that and when I heard that, I realized that you can kind of see it, that sort of energy to the characters, the fascination with place and how characters navigate them, even though Nesbit was a children's author. And then, of course, she moves on to be a fan of, I think, The Usual Suspects. She was a huge fan of Arthur Conan Doyle, Wilkie Collins, and you can definitely see the strains of those kinds of mystery writing coming into her work later. I was hard-pressed to find other female writers who wrote mysteries that she would have read. And I think that's also interesting because there actually weren't very many at all.
No, and she struggled to get published in the first place. Yes. So I think her first book was rejected by six separate publishers. And so it took a lot of reworking. It took some family connections. It took quite a bit, you know, for her to get to a point where A, she was getting published, and then after that, she was getting steadily published. Because while it took a while for that first book or that first story to gain any attention from the publishing industry, earlier we ran through the fact that she sells. And so I think in her own lifetime, she did that too. She was a household name early on in her career. It didn't actually take that long. I think that to your point about there not being that many, part of it has to do perhaps with some of the barriers to getting published that we've spoken about with women in the past. I mean, she initially wrote her first few stories and novels under a pseudonym.
Monosyllaba, which I was just, that's hilarious.
It is. It's such a... That is definitely a lonely child name. I think that, so perhaps that has something to do with it. It is worth saying, though, that she was somebody who was a known quantity, who was a household name in her own lifetime, which not all authors are.
And it's a testament to the quality of her work that actually it really only took that first publication for her to shoot to being the sensation that she would then go on to be, because the novel that she first got published, which turned out to be an Hercule Poirot novel, The Mysterious Affair at Styles, that was her first publication, and it was a sensation. And following then, all of her following books have been widely acclaimed and had the kind of readership that most people could only dream of. And I think that has to do with the fact that it was a genre that was so popular as well.
Lots of books, right, in her lifetime. So when we say that she became a bit of a sensation, I think it's important to put that in context. So 66 detective novels, 14 short story collections. She also had six novels that were published under another pseudonym, not Monosyllaba, but Mary Westmacott. And those, I think, had more of a mystical air, similar to her contemporary of sorts, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. She was somebody who wrote very logical, very tightly plotted books, who also believed in mysticism and in spirituality. So that's an interesting, I guess, push and pull for both of them.
So the question of structure or plot, I think, is interesting. Now, I mean, I know we're going to spend a lot of time talking about Poirot and Miss Marple, but because most of her books follow that very similar structure, I think one of the things that makes Agatha Christie both so readable, but also that illusion of it being almost simple, unlike, say, an Arthur Conan Doyle, is the fact that they are written in this deceptively simplistic way. When everything is laid out, once the mystery is resolved, it's resolved so neatly and so beautifully that you kind of feel like, oh, well, I see. But in truth, though, I remember that every time I read it, and when I reread the books, I realize I forget what happens at the end. I often have to go through the journey of the mystery again because of how well they're written.
Do we want to talk about her style now? Is now the time that we dive into the signature Agatha Christie moves?
Well, I think we might have to take a break, so perhaps we'll save that for the second half of the show.
Yes, because I want to respond to that. You know, the fact that you have these mysteries that, like you say, sometimes you read it first for the story and then for the mystery, and then you return to find out the path, right? It's one of those things with her books. But we'll get to that. We're talking today about Agatha Christie and her massive writing career. It is a lot of ground to cover. Are you an Agatha Christie reader? Do you enjoy mysteries? You know, what do you like about them? You can share your thoughts with us. WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can, of course, also tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Dead Man's Mirror by Agatha Christie. Read by Hugh Fraser. The flat was a modern one. The furnishings of the room were modern too. The armchairs were squarely built. The upright chairs were angular. A modern writing table was set squarely in front of the window, and at it sat a small, elderly man. His head was practically the only thing in the room that was not square. It was egg-shaped. Monsieur Hercule Poirot was reading a letter. Dear sir, a matter has arisen which requires handling with great delicacy and discretion. I have heard good accounts of you, and have decided to entrust the matter to you. I have reason to believe that I am the victim of fraud, but for family reasons I do not wish to call in the police. I am taking certain measures of my own to deal with the business, but you must be prepared to come down here immediately on receipt of a telegram. I shall be obliged if you will not answer this letter. Yours faithfully, Gervaise Chevenix Gore. The eyebrows of Monsieur Hercule Poirot climbed slowly up his forehead until they nearly disappeared into his hair. And who, then, he demanded of space, is this Gervaise Chevenix Gore? He crossed to a bookcase and took out a large...
Hello, this is By the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. Today it is our bibliography episode and we're talking about Agatha Christie. So right before we took that little break, Sharmila, you were talking about how when you read an Agatha Christie novel, sometimes you read it the first time through just to find out what happens, and then you have to go back for the story. And I think that there are a couple of things to pass here, right? So firstly, her writing style is very easy to read. It's just descriptive enough without necessarily piling you with lots and lots of detail, which I think some mystery writers are prone to doing. They kind of chuck all the clues at you so that you don't see it. Her writing style is quite clean. And she, of course, had her signature detectives who populated many of her books, who she's perhaps best remembered for, Hercule Poirot, as well as Miss Marple. And I don't know, the first few times I read Agatha Christie, I sort of gave up on trying to figure it out. You know, are you the kind of person who wants to know if they're proven right in the end, or are you just reading for reading's sake?
No, I definitely like being quote unquote the detective in the novel. But I find that with Agatha Christie, it's almost impossible.
Right.
It's a perfect little puzzle box that it's just one of those things that someone has to unravel for you and you're along for the ride. And I think with Christie, I've kind of accepted that that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah, so I am generally speaking somebody who really likes just reading along. I don't know if I'm an anomaly in this, but for detective novels, I tend to switch my brain off more than usual. So I'm trying even less to figure it out or to piece it together because I just like being on the journey.
So I think that's interesting because for me to be able to do that, and I guess that's why I can do it with Christie, I need a really strong detective to take me along because then I'm sort of just shadowing him or her. And that really brings us to the two characters that she created, right? Miss Marple and Poirot. I will admit I'm much more a Poirot fan than I am Miss Marple's, but they're both those kinds, the kinds where you're willing to place your trust in their hands because you know that in the end, they're going to explain it all so beautifully and it's all going to click into place.
What's great about both characters is that they're very, very flawed and their flaws are up front. So Hercule Poirot with his moustache and his Belgian accent. No, 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 I'm not French, I'm Belgian. His perfectly egg-shaped
head.
It's just a signature description. He is your, in many ways, your classic egotistical detective. You know, he's somebody who has a very great belief in his own intelligence and everyone around him also regards him as, oh, that guy. And so with that, because he's eccentric, comes the pleasure of reading someone who's quite charming, but also that that arrogance that sometimes you want with a detective. Now, Miss Marple, on the other hand, so she's described as a spinster, right? She's sort of this...
To use the unfashionable term.
Correct. But that is how she's described in the book. So she is a spinster character who is not so much a professional detective the way Poirot is, but sort of pieces things together by believing the worst in people. So even that is an interesting lens, and it's one that is very consistent. They're both consistent always throughout their books.
Yes, and you know, the main difference, of course, being that she tends to solve mysteries that are fairly centered around her little town. Mm. I mean, there have been a few, I think, where she's kind of strayed beyond the bounds of the town. But like you said, Poirot is much more of a international sleuth. You find him in different places around the world. Miss Marple, on the other hand, And I like that. I like that you have those two contrasts, because it's the difference between, let's say, a Famous Five and a Secret Seven. I'm picking another female writer, but there you go. It's because it's nice to adventure in the known as well as it is the unknown. And it's to Chrissy's credit that she actually creates such great mysteries in these very domestic spaces.
So can I say, though, with that said, and yes, the Marple novels are more domestic and more rustic almost in feel. However, one of the hallmarks of a Christie novel are that the settings are always intimate. So you have the final scene, right? Which
small spaces and...
Correct. And you always have the scene where the detective brings everybody into the drawing room, the parlor, the living room, what have you, and explains, you know, step by step what happens. I can't wait for those moments usually. But if you think, or if you cast your mind to any Agatha Christie book or any Agatha Christie inspired writer, the cast of characters is always very small, very tight. So even if you are talking about something that happened on an archaeological dig, on a train in Europe, wherever it may be, it's usually a group of 10 people, let's say, and usually with their own very specific entanglements as well. And that intimacy is what makes those novels work.
And it's a weird sort of intimacy, isn't it? Because they are in themselves not extremely complex. They are there to play a certain role. Mm. And so you get to know them, but you also get to know them as tropes. I think, again, that gets us back to the question of genre, because there is a pleasure in these tropes. There is a familiarity and a shape that we as readers recognize. And I think sometimes that is what genre does, that genre books do that more literary books can't, which is to create that familiar space for readers to just kind of nest in. And Agatha Christie really, I think, pioneered the thing that you just spoke about, that detective reveal, which we see now over and over again in books, in movies, in TV shows. And honestly, because that's not something you see in, say, an Arthur Conan Doyle. He has a very specific way of resolving the mystery. But I dare say, I don't think anyone else was really doing it in that way before Agatha Christie was.
No, I think it's very much something that she began. And so I think when you talk about things like genre, right, and how easy it can be to overlook genre writers, sometimes warranted, unwarranted, we can debate that. But it's important to not overlook the pioneers. And in this instance, you know, she really was the pioneer of this sort of structure. So she has been criticized for a number of different things. So there's classism. Mm. There's those lovely stereotypes that we talked about, which, again, are a product of when she was born, how long she lived. So 1890 to 1976, I think, is the period that we're talking about. So those two things, her language and whether or not it works always, is something else that has come up.
She's also been criticized for exactly some of the things that we've actually been sounding very positive about, which is an oversimplicity, characters not being deep, you know. But again, these are all criticisms that are often leveled at genre writing. And I do want to say, and I think this came up a little bit when we spoke about Jane Austen as well, I think sometimes the gender does play a part, because we don't often see the same kinds of criticism being leveled at Sherlock Holmes books. They are in no less in their own way formulaic. Arthur Conan Doyle famously hated writing them because of how formulaic they'd become. Agatha Christie actually struggled with similar feelings with Poirot as well, even though she never tried to kill him off. but I do think there is a little bit of a lack of balance when it comes to these kinds of criticism.
I actually think that the classism also plays a huge role, because in both instances, we're talking about women who were relatively well off and who lived... Okay, so Agatha Christie did not live a sheltered life. I don't think we actually covered enough of kind of what she did in the scope of her lifetime, and we can return to that. But they both lived life in a certain strata of society, and so they both wrote about that strata. Everybody does have tea for some reason, no matter how stressed out the situation is. There'll be somebody nursing a cup of good Earl Grey and having a biscuit. And so... yes, it's a certain style. And I think with that also brings those criticisms, because the stereotypes that we're talking about, some of them are also stereotypes based on how rich the writer was and who the writer knew.
Yes, and her particular view of the world as well. But I'm glad you brought up her personal life, because we maybe should have talked about it a little earlier, but I think this seems like a good a time as any to just talk about the fact that she was so prolific. I think often overshadows how dramatic her personal life was, which in many ways takes as many turns as some of her books. So as you said earlier, she was married first, and then she got divorced. And the thing that I remember being shocked by when I read about it was how she actually went through this breakdown essentially when her first marriage failed, and she in fact disappeared for I think up to 10 days and nobody knew where she was. And this wasn't dissimilar to something that she went through when her mother passed away, who she was very close to. And again, she went through this bout of depression trying to deal with the grief of that. And all of this for me makes someone who I think can often seem quite remote quite human in many ways.
I think in polite society, we just call it the disappearance. Because she actually never referred to it after.
She never really talked about it. Yeah.
Never. She published, there was an autobiography published after she passed away. And in that, she makes no mention of the fact that she disappeared for 11 days. Her car and a change of clothes was found at like a quarry, crashed into a quarry.
People thought she had staged a murder to try and frame her ex-husband. And I mean, yes, that's right.
She showed up. When they found her, they found her in a hotel under the name of her husband's mistress.
Yes, yes. So there's so many fascinating layers to that. I mean, we don't know, so I don't really want to judge what happened. But then she goes on to marry a man who was 13 years younger than her.
And an archaeologist.
Yes, and then just proceeds to travel, you know, all over the world with him. Her train journeys with him basically inspired Murder on the Orient Express. She has an interest in everything from Egyptology to archaeology to pharmacology. Clearly, we can't cover the depth and breadth of Agatha Christie's life in our show. But I feel like all of these things point to how she's able to write the way she does with that amount of, you know, what's the word for prolificity? Is that a word?
Prolificness? Let's go with that.
Yes. That consistently and basically take you all around the world through her mysteries.
Yes. She actually worked in hospitals during the world wars. And in both, I think she gained a huge understanding and interest in pharmacology, which also is why so many victims were poisoned in her books. But I just wanted to say that you often hear the phrase, write what you know. And I think in the case of Agatha Christie, you see that translated into a huge variety and settings of, you know, for people to get murdered, basically, which not many people can say.
Yes, and I've often wondered ever since I found out about her personal life, how much of her own dark phases helps her gain an insight into the darker side of humanity. Because again, it's not something that you would imagine a woman of a certain standing would spend much time thinking about or even be really exposed to. But she manages to translate that so well into her books.
So I thought before we move on to footnotes, we could just finish on the issue of language, because we've talked about storytelling and plotting, but we haven't really talked about Agatha Christie's language. Being a detective writer, how she plots her stories really matter, but we haven't, I think, talked enough about how she writes them.
You know, it's weird. Agatha Christie is one of those writers that I find difficult to think about in terms of language. Maybe because that's my own failing and her books are not the kind that I sit down with the thought of, I'm going to focus on language. But when I think about it, I often think about her in the same way I think of Wodehouse, where there's a simplicity and a deceptiveness to how well-crafted they are, that they manage to evoke emotions in you without you realizing what they're doing. And I think that's the mark of a really good writer.
I think the comparison to Wodehouse is excellent, partly because of, like you say, the simplicity of language and the flashes of humor. In Wodehouse, it's waves of humor, but in Christie, it's more like little dashes. But I think the other thing is also the particular style of English of that time, because her books are incredibly English. They, like we said earlier, kind of tend to circulate in a very specific segment of society. And so whenever I reread or I plan to read an Agatha Christie book, it takes me, I would say, 20 pages to kind of acclimatize myself to, right, okay, cheerio, and this is where we are now. And then after that, it's completely fine. But in the first few moments, there is, and I think, you know, it's been in some cases more than 100 years since her books were first published. And so I think that that's a natural adjustment to make.
Yes, and I wonder whether people can even write like that anymore, in the sense that it was a very particular viewpoint, wasn't it? Even her approach to writing someone like Poirot, who isn't English, is informed by a sense of Englishness. It's an English person's idea of what a Belgian refugee detective might be like.
And not so positive sometimes.
Yes, no, that's right. And I think part of that acclimatization has to do with us realizing and remembering that this is not a book from our time.
Mm, absolutely. However, adaptations of those books have, in some cases, edged over into our time. And that's what we're going to be talking about next. And maybe even throwing in a couple of our favorite reads because we didn't get there. But are you a fan of Agatha Christie? Do you enjoy reading her works? Would you like to share some favorites maybe? You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Brings us to Footnotes, where we traditionally talk about adaptations of the author's works. But first, I thought we could maybe touch on some favorites.
You know, I think I'm just going to go for the one. And ironically, it's a standalone. It features neither Poirot nor Miss Marple, just because it was probably one of the earliest Agatha Christie's I remember. But I still think it's one of the best examples of a mystery novel. And Then There Were None. Or you might know it as its other title, which is not polite to be used anymore, 10 Little Something. It's that classic put 10 people into a space that they can't get away from. People start dying one by one. They don't know what's happening. And most famously, it has a really non-traditional ending for a novel, for a mystery novel. I love it. I just reread it quite recently and I was blown away still by how well written and what an immersive mystery it is.
I haven't read it actually, but I know of it. And the story is, I don't want to give too much away, but I think just as the parlor room reveal is kind of an Agatha Christie pioneering signature move, I think that this whole locked room mystery perpetrator thing was also in some ways, if not the first of its kind, then definitely one of the most popular and influential of its type. My favorite Agatha Christie, I think, is just going to have to be the first one I read, which is Death on the Nile. And I loved it so much because I remember reading it and not being able to put it down, but also of feeling, to go back to that point we were making about how you have to almost feel English back in the early 1900s, you know? I think that that book, I actually felt the oppressive heat of Egypt. I could feel it. I could feel the irritation, the dryness, the all these things that permeate the book and make the solving of the mystery that much more pressing. I felt that. And I think till now, whenever I think about my favorites, that's the one that comes up.
And I think Death on the Nile, followed very closely by Murder at the Orient Express, are the most Poirot of Poirot novels.
Oh, yes.
If you want to know what he's like and what his mystery solving is, those are the ones to go to.
If you want to decide if you like him or not.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I have a feeling that that's a great segue to talking about your favorite adaptation of a Christie book as well.
Yeah, so favorite is kind of a tricky one, but I really liked, I have to say, I really enjoyed Murder on the Orient Express that was directed by Kenneth Branagh and typically starred Kenneth Branagh as...
Me too. And despite the fact that it didn't actually get very good reviews, I hugely enjoyed it.
You know, there is something about a tangle of strangers pressed together for days with nothing in common but the need to go from one place to another and never see each other again. I see evil on this train. A passenger has died.
So they got him after all. You assume he was killed?
No, not. Well, he was in perfectly good health. He had his enemies.
Indeed, he was murdered.
Good God, murder here. God rest his soul.
Someone was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night. No one would listen to me.
If there was a murder...
What is going on?
Then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us.
And every one of you is a suspect.
And who are you?
My name is Hercule Poirot, and I am probably the greatest detective in the world.
You know what I liked about it? I think that it captured what an adaptation of Murder on the Orient Express should do, which is that propulsive sense of traveling through somewhere, of being neither here nor there. It had that crazy cast. It just has all these things that I want in a modern adaptation of an Agatha Christie book, which is to say it's not perfect, but it was good to look at. I enjoyed spending time with it. And I like that it is off this time, I think.
So I was trying to think of my favorite adaptations, and I'm going to do a bit of a cheat. Firstly, I was going to say that I really, really loved a staging of The Mousetrap, which is one of Christie's plays. She first wrote it as a radio play, and then it became a stage play, and it's the longest running West End production of all time. It came to Malaysia about 7 or 8 years ago. And you know, if you want to know what it's like to watch a staging of an Agatha Christie play, how it plays out in real life, you can do no better than watching Mousetrap being staged. It's just lovely to watch a mystery on stage. And famously, you're always asked not to reveal the ending once you've watched it. So it's kind of a little compact between the audience and the staging, I suppose.
In connection with the murder, the police are anxious to interview a man seen in the vicinity, wearing a dark overcoat, light scarf, and soft felt hat.
There are 7 of you here tonight. One of you is the murderer.
Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap. This classic theatrical murder mystery is now in its 60th anniversary year.
I know for a fact people are hiding things.
The play was originally written for the BBC as a short story titled Three Blind Mice for Queen Mary's 80th birthday, as she had asked for a new Agatha Christie. Christie adapted it for the stage, and The Mousetrap opened in London's West End in 1952. An immediate sellout hit. It is now the longest ever continuously running stage show, a position it has held for an astonishing 53 years.
I've always dreamed of watching The Mousetrap someday. I always thought that, I know it's a little bit of a stereotype and that, you know, it's a bit of a pleb move to go to the West End and, you know, and watch The Mousetrap. But I always thought that if I made it there, that that's what I would do. And I have always loved exactly what you said, that thing about you're not supposed to reveal the ending, you're actively asked not to, and that's something that's been in place ever since they first started staging it. Sadly, the play closed down last year, just another thing that COVID-19 kind of affected. But yeah, I hope someday to see a staging of it.
So when I said I was going to cheat, I didn't want to say, though, that I'm also picking a Agatha Christie-inspired movie, which is Knives Out, which came out last year. Only because if you ever wanted to see how much can be done with that format, Knives Out is not based on an Agatha Christie novel, but everything about it, from the characters to the setting, to the twists and turns of the mystery, and the whole Americanization of it. So it is essentially the American version of the classic British mystery. So much potential. Such a beautiful film. And Rian Johnson was inspired by the idea of making an Agatha Christie adaptation anyway.
And the most ridiculous detective, like the most ridiculous detective, as played by Daniel Craig. Such a good one. And they are going to have a sequel to that. So it is a good time to catch up on that if you're thinking about it. Yeah, so we've been talking today about Agatha Christie, first about her life and times and work, and then subsequently about the adaptations of those works. If you would like to weigh in, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.